Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we got a look into a seasonal category of retail that might have a better than expected retail season. We'll also talk about the latest bad news for Gap, PPE and retail. More importantly, if a PPE retailer could make it in a brick and mortar sense. And we'll also talk briefly about Stein Mart to wrap up the show. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other podcast listening service. If you like us, those ratings help others to find us. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. And we begin with the earnings call we've been waiting for as Kroger reveals their quarterly results this week. Now, we did get the numbers. We got a few other details. Honestly, I didn't feel as though the analyst questions on the call were super useful from a retail perspective. A lot of them were talking about the pension. A lot of them were talking about e-commerce things that we already knew about, like, for example, the retail partnership that Kroger has with Ocado. But we did get some numbers ahead of their annual meeting of shareholders, which occurs on June 25th, 2020.
And while we've gotten sales updates for Kroger up to this point, we've been warned that their additional revenue has come at the expense of profitability in some cases. However, it was clear that Kroger was able to capitalize on the newfound traffic due to the pandemic, a lot more customers coming into their stores. Their first fiscal quarter ended on May 23rd, 2020. So this is a look into around 10 weeks or so of the pandemic buying patterns. And if you look at the numbers, basically everything was up significantly for Kroger, including profits. We'll start with comp sales, though, or as they call them, identical sales. Identical sales were up 19% for them, which was an outstanding number, but not one that we thought was outside of the realm of possibility given the heavy early pandemic buying. This number, by the way, does not include fuel sales. We know that fuel prices were massively down in the quarter, although fuel margins were way up. Digital sales for Kroger saw a 92% increase, and although this was undoubtedly a huge increase, it was honestly lightly surprising that this number was not higher. Still, their platform was already reasonably mature going into the quarter with over 2,000 pickup-enabled locations and 2,400 delivery-enabled locations, reaching over 97% of their total current customer base. And there are some outliers in the more rural areas, of course, but those major metropolitan areas, Trent, are covered. To put online sales impacts into perspective here, their digital sales only provided a 3% boost to identical sales, despite nearly doubling over last year. Brick and mortar still very much drives grocery sales, as it does for a number of retailers that we cover here on the podcast. Although more did use the digital sales platform, supposedly, in the most recent quarter. And I think that really speaks to, again, people being wary, some percentage of the population being wary to go into the brick and mortar setting, and we'll see if that conversion or that adoption of their platform relates to sales in the future. But CEO Rodney McMullen said that in terms of overall sales, only 6.5 to 7% of overall sales were in fact digital. Additionally, they noted on the call that the average new customer that enters the Kroger platform, the e-commerce platform, takes around 3 to 4 years to become actually profitable for the company because of all of the money that they've put into that platform. And a lot of people aren't buying hundreds of dollars per transaction on said platform. So that could definitely hurt them in terms of those short-term margin gains. As a result of the increased comp sales, though, total revenue was up to $42 billion compared to $37 billion last year, that $5 billion increase. And those numbers, however, did include fuel sales, as those comp numbers did not. As far as the bottom line is concerned, Kroger did see a major impact on their profit numbers. As we referenced, Kroger has talked about additional hazard pay to employees, retrofitting some stores, and other hasty infrastructure developments as a major reason why the increase in sales might not directly parlay itself into a major leap in those profits. They still found a way, though, to be profitable in a big way, as their operating profit came in at $1.33 billion. This, by the way, compares to $901 million last year, so a jump of around $430 million in profit. And if you take that and divide that by the $5 billion or so that was added to their total revenue increase, you can see that they are at least profiting on some of that increase. Their first in, first out gross margin rate also increased 44 basis points. All of this led, Trent, to earnings per share of $1.52, although adjusted earnings per share was $1.22. Either metric you use, though, provides an approximate 50 cent per share bump over last year. One of the major headlines for them, by the way, on the call was the amount of investment into COVID-related infrastructure and safeguards, which they pegged at around $830 million.
And that includes the hazard pay to associates. The company noted also on the day of the earnings call that there was another, what they call a thank you pay or thank you bonus, basically given to associates that works into that $830 million. So you can see just how much the additional expenditures kind of eroded the profit. Still, as Layton points out, a massive jump, a $430 million jump in overall profit. And in terms of the comp sales or the identical store sales, I think 19% is a fair number for Kroger and certainly something that you would expect from a grocer. We got insight, by the way, Thursday night as far as Albertsons sales during the pandemic because they announced their IPO, which we'll see if that comes to fruition. It's been announced a few different times now. They've had a few false starts over the last 5 years as far as the IPO, but Albertsons said our identical store sales jumped 34% on a year-over-year basis between March 1st and April 25th. So you take that into account for Kroger's overall quarter. You figure, hey, there are probably a few weeks in there from February and a few weeks in there from May where the sales maybe didn't jump as much year-over-year. 19% comes out to be, I think, a pretty good number for Kroger on the whole. Now, as far as notes on the call, I mentioned already that there wasn't a lot of talk as far as sales cadence on the call. A lot of focus from the analysts on e-commerce, on pension payments to employees, and that type of thing. Something that we haven't discussed, though, and I found this interesting that it came up on the quarter because it no doubt helped Kroger's sales in the quarter, is their expansion of check cashing services. Now, we've talked about the fairly large number of unbanked individuals in the U.S. previously. You have a number of individuals that for whatever reason either can't, won't, or don't have a bank account. So Kroger sought to kind of capitalize on this by offering free check cashing for stimulus, unemployment, and Social Security checks. The hope there is obviously that you're providing a benefit to the unbanked out there, but you're also giving them a wad of cash to where they might just spend it while they're in the store. And these checks, when you look at these particular checks that they're cashing, they carry next to no risk to cash because most cases the government isn't going to say there's insufficient funds. But it gives Kroger that opportunity to maybe draw in those new customers because of that service. The very least, you're putting cash in existing customers' hands. And one thing I wanted to point out is this was somewhat of a commonplace practice, at least for retail employees. We've heard stories from, just as an example, longtime Kmart employees that they would, Kmart would, that is, cash paychecks in the back of their store that they would give to the employees many years ago, basically give them a lot of cash in an attempt to entice the employees to spend the cash on their way out of the store. And this was a more commonplace practice before checking accounts, before debit cards were that big of a thing back in the 80s and the 90s. Same concept here, but instead of employees, you're looking at customers and you're providing convenience to that customer as well, because again, you're doing this with no fee attached. Now, to date, just to put a number to this, they've cashed nearly 230,000 checks since implementing this service. That's an insane number of checks that they've been cashing. Total value there of $244 million. So you know that's going to provide some incremental benefit, and it could continue to provide that benefit as stimulus checks continue to float out. But not only stimulus checks, again, keep in mind, unemployment checks were included in this. We've got a massive amount of unemployed Americans. So again, Kroger, this gives them an opportunity to both provide a service to their customers and give those customers some cash that they can potentially spend on those necessities in the Kroger stores. Now, something else interesting that they've noted, their COVID-19 incident rate among employees is tracking meaningfully below the markets where they operate. Now, when a Kroger associate does test positive for COVID-19, it is likely to garner headlines, but they've done the research and they found that basically Kroger employees have had less of a chance of contracting a virus than others, the general population, in those markets. Now, granted, we should add the caveat that there aren't a lot of nursing home individuals that are employed at Kroger stores. And again, we know nursing homes, assisted living facilities, they've been impacted in an outsized fashion by the spread of COVID-19. But back to Kroger, their overall accident rates, things like falls and whatnot, currently among the lowest in the company's history as well. So we're not only talking about an emphasis on safety as far as making sure others don't catch COVID-19 or their employees don't spread COVID-19 if they've got it, or they don't get COVID-19 in the first place, but we're talking about overall safety mechanisms that have come into play. And that's huge because, as Layton will talk about here in just a second, they hired a bunch of new employees. So to be able to onboard those new employees, have them working safely in an environment such as this, very, very important for Kroger.
We know at this point the categories that saw major growth, but Kroger pointed out a few on the call that we haven't yet discussed. Their private label plant-based products under the Simple Truth banner, 32% growth in the first quarter, outpacing much of the rest of grocery. As it was, their private label products and brands saw decent growth as well, with their three largest private label brands witnessing 21.1% growth in the quarter. While it was discussed earlier in the quarter that they would be aiming to hire 100,000 new employees, they noted that the onboarding process was actually easier than anticipated in some markets. And I think that's because of all of the online training tools they have for their associates now and all of the money they've been spending over the last 2 to 3 years to help with that HR process. Their hourly average for new hires is $15 per hour, $20 per hour if you factor in some of the benefits that Kroger has made available. And Kroger is a more attractive employer than others who are ramping up hiring. It is arguable there, allowing them to see a fairly large number of applications. There are a lot of other industries that probably aren't as good as the one that Kroger provides. And this is probably coming from a biased area because Trent and I are both fans of retail. But their onboarding process, focused largely on culture and safety in this accelerated environment, took on average 72 hours for each new employee. However, they did note that several employees hired during this time were furloughed from their original jobs, meaning that they are seeing some attrition as they return to their original jobs at the conclusion of the furlough. Although the vast majority of analyst questions were about e-commerce and their Ocado partnership, there were a few questions regarding the cadence of sales so far in Q2. Roddy McMullen, their CEO, said that customers have continued to tell Kroger of their plans to eat more meals at home going forward. Therefore, Kroger figures to continue to capitalize on related sales and doesn't appear to be making any download adjustments to their staffing numbers. Additionally, McMullen mentioned that while delivery was a major driver of their increase in e-commerce sales during the first quarter, they've seen more momentum towards grocery pickup as markets reopen and customers become more comfortable with going inside those brick and mortar locations. Finally, they noted significant momentum back towards their Home Chef line of make-at-home meals. This dovetails with what we've seen from Blue Apron and others since the pandemic started, sort of a lifeline for those kind of projects and products right now in this particular industry.
So a lot going on in grocery, and although this earnings call maybe wasn't as fruitful in certain areas that we had hoped, one thing that we are looking forward to is future Albertsons earnings calls. Now, Albertsons is pretty transparent as far as sales is concerned because of that eye on the IPO, but again, you're looking at Albertsons potentially having share prices between the $18 to $20 range. You're looking at kind of an implied valuation for them of $10 billion based on a sale of a stake to Apollo Global Management last month. So lots to look forward to in the grocery industry. And what's more is Kroger didn't note that sales had plummeted in late May to early June, which was the period after this quarter finished off. So I think some positives there certainly to take out of the call from Kroger, even if the e-commerce sales that all the analysts love to talk about still only accounted for 6.5 to 7% of Kroger's overall sales. Coming up, we're going to talk about seasonal retail, more specifically fireworks. We'll get some insight on fireworks sales, not only for this year, but the general process behind setting up retail fireworks stands. We'll also discuss more bad news for Gap. Well, as we talked about in the open, this is a part of retail that we've explored briefly in the past, but it may potentially have a big summer season thanks to a study coming out of Florida. We're talking, of course, about fireworks as we begin to see fireworks stands pop up throughout the country. Definitely a part of retail, along with kind of those pop-up garden centers and the like that kind of gets overlooked a little bit, but we think it should be basically viewed in the same breath as some of the Halloween stores that pop up around that time of year, some of the Christmas stores that pop up around the later time of the year. Before we get into the story, we wanted to provide some background on this segment. And we talked briefly with Jason Marietta, who's the retail director at Jake's Fireworks, about what setting up for the season entails.
They actually are independent contractors that operate each location. And so they run it, you know, and sometimes it's, you know, a group. It varies there, but they're actually independent contractors that operate the location, and they decide, you know, when they're open and things like that. They basically, you know, purchase the fireworks and then return them at the end of the year. They're running it, you know, basically for their group for that short period of time. It actually starts more than a year in advance with trying to place the order to China for the next upcoming year. And so, you know, utilizing the ordering process and trying to get all of those things so that China gets a jump on it to then try to produce it, because you have to think about it globally. You've got the European market, which is huge into New Year's, but then you've got Guy Fawkes Day in England, and you had Victoria Day just recently here in Canada, things like that, Diwali, all kinds of those holidays that then China's not just looking at it from the U.S. perspective, but from a global perspective, and so you have to try to get your order in way in advance to then get it out so that, you know, you have fireworks coming in January, February, March, you know, for the upcoming 4th of July season.
We thank Jason for his insight. Now, meanwhile, in looking how fireworks retail traffic is shaping up for the season, Layton, we turn to an unusual source.
That source is a healthcare system, Orlando Health. Of course, healthcare systems have a dog in this fight, since the greater the sales of fireworks to households, the potential for accidents owing to lack of attention to safety is also greater, of course. The study by Orlando Health indicates that around 40% of Americans are planning to purchase their own fireworks this summer. I am not, Trent. I know you probably aren't either in your municipality, but 16% of those who do plan to purchase their own fireworks say that cancellations owing to COVID-19 are a factor in their decision. And you see, of course, many local fireworks shows will not be held this year over social distancing concerns. So some families may take matters into their own hands and provide their own shows in their own neighborhoods. Fast Company noted that New York City saw a 4,000% increase in firework complaints during the first 2 weeks. Of course, not all is good news for fireworks manufacturers, since there will be a lower number of purchases from the companies, organizations, and cities. They will lose those sales on the back end of things. So, however, customer traffic may be up at tents and seasonal sites, which is good for those local employers there that are trying to benefit from those local sites. But like other types of retail who have benefited from the pandemic, it will now be up to those fireworks stands to ensure that 2020 customers become a 2021 customer, even with some fireworks shows returning in theory by 2021. This could ultimately be great news for operators of fireworks retail locations, many of whom are paid on a commission basis. A potential increase in sales will mean an increase in their income, of course, or an increase for their nonprofit, as many fireworks stands are run for benefit of a local charity or church in some parts of the country. One devil's advocate point we would be remiss to not make here. Although this study from Orlando Health says that the raw number of people purchasing fireworks is projected to go up, it does not speak to the amount of money people plan on spending. It could be that these fireworks stands will have new customers. Still, previous customers may not spend as much on extravagant displays if their income has been negatively impacted by the pandemic. And we know that is certainly the case for many parts of the population. The sheer unemployment numbers suggest that we'll see some backing off, but it really is tough to tell.
Yeah, and as we've mentioned before, tobacco and liquor sales don't usually fall off too much in pandemic buying conditions. And sometimes that flies in the face of what you would initially think when you look at it. Say, people might be spending money on alcohol, but might be spending money on Coors Light instead of New Belgium, let's say. In this particular case, though, if we look at this and seeing if fireworks belong in this same resistant category, or maybe a discretionary category instead, I think it's important to look back to 2009 as an example, because going back to July 2008, we're looking, and that's right before the financial crisis hit. We saw unemployment numbers skyrocket at that point in time. Fireworks sales actually went up slightly from 2008 to 2009. When you look at unemployment numbers also went up during that time. However, we should note that despite the fact that the historical perspective suggests that fireworks sales might be resistant and might be able to overcome any ballooning in unemployment or underemployment there, the unemployment rate in 2009 was listed around the beginning of July at about 9%, and we're seeing numbers generally higher than that right now, although I think there is some thought that a lot of those numbers are temporary and some of these jobs might be restored once things begin to open back up, and we're already seeing that in some areas of the country. So I think this is a different circumstance than what a typical recession would be, but one thing we do know is that a lot of community fireworks shows have been canceled because of the social distancing issues, and we do know that a lot of people seem to be reporting that they're going to put on their own fireworks shows at home. Now, whether they get together as a neighborhood to do this, whether everyone is just kind of an independent contractor on their own fireworks shows, time will tell, but it, at least at this point, looks like it could be a good summer for retail fireworks in the U.S. Well, we'll close up this show by talking about the latest bad news for Gap. Several smaller stories out there that we wanted to cover, including Neiman Marcus's potential exit from bankruptcy, but this kind of rose to the forefront because of some interesting comments that Gap made this last week. Brookfield Property Partners now takes them to court for unpaid rents. And we talked a couple of weeks ago about the Simon case that was filed. The company is still in the midst of dealing with that. Simon basically saying, hey, you're not paying us rents. You owe us $65 million worth of rents. This particular case, though, with Brookfield was filed in Texas. And unlike the Simon case, Brookfield was very clear that Gap is not paying rent for even the locations that have reopened. So according to court papers, Brookfield claims that, and I quote this, for 3 months running, Gap has failed to pay rent at virtually every Brookfield location nationwide, even for stores that Gap is operating. They went on to say, and again I quote, at present, Gap has withheld more than $2 million in rent from Brookfield in Texas alone. The other interesting aspect to this court filing is that apparently Gap is refusing to reopen stores in certain Brookfield malls that have already been open for some time. And again, we talk about Texas as an area, one of the first to reopen, especially in terms of malls and apparel stores. As a background, many leases in malls or larger retail centers stipulate that businesses must be open for customer traffic within certain parameters. Now, not every lease stipulates this, but many do. Basically, they've got clauses there where unless your business closes altogether, you have to be open for a certain amount of time while the mall is open, although these clauses are different across properties and retailers. And just to bring about a recent case that we saw this brought up in, Teavana, when Starbucks was going about closing those stores, that was a big point of contention because a lot of those leases said, hey, Starbucks has a duty, according to the leases, to operate this store while Teavana is still functional and while Starbucks is still functional. So short of maybe a bankruptcy or something like that, these clauses can be difficult to get out of and require some sort of settlement between the landlords and the property owners.
So after news of the initial Simon suit against Gap, Gap CEO Sonia Syngal said that they were in talks with landlords and they were paying what they consider fair rent. However, if you look now, Trent, based on Brookfield's words from their statements, it appears as though that Gap may consider maybe $0 fair rent in certain properties or in certain markets. Gap said in a statement this past Thursday that they are attempting to work with landlords on, I quote, mutually agreeable solutions and fair rent terms, end quote. They also noted that they've reached agreements with current landlords, many of whom are still doing somewhat decent in this time of pandemic, but Gap is reopening some of those stores that they've reached agreements with, and Gap executives also hinted to analysts here recently that where agreements could not be reached with landlords, they could be forced to close stores permanently. This seems like an odd goal for Gap because simply closing locations doesn't preclude you from paying rent in most cases. Typically, you have to pay an early lease withdrawal fee or something of that nature. So additionally, we know from their last earnings call that their e-commerce sales aren't exactly surging. In fact, e-commerce sales at Gap and Banana Republic were down in aggregate. Old Navy's, of course, were up, Old Navy being the one bright spot for the company. This is during a time in which, even without pandemic conditions, most retailers are seeing high single or low double-digit gains in e-commerce sales year over year. So Gap basically has no leverage here unless they threaten bankruptcy. As Neil Saunders of Global Data Retail pointed out, without brick and mortar stores, Gap won't have top of mind awareness or just the pure strength in brand, and customers will have zero reason basically to shop their e-commerce sites without the brick and mortar stores. And the point being made here is that many people aren't going to their website as it is. So if their stores close, realistically, how much traffic are you going to convert in most of these markets? Basically, we see Gap's statement here as a declaration that they don't really care to be in business any longer in many of these locations that they aren't paying rent in. Other than the employees that would be affected, there would be precious few people, it seems, who would actually care if Gap and Banana Republic went away. Although Old Navy is still strong comparative to other retailers, that would probably be a brand that sustains and lasts through bankruptcy if there were an auction for certain assets and things of that nature. But right now, Trent, it appears as though the landlords are really trying to get the last bit of cash that Gap has on their balance sheets.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I pick out a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And this week, we begin with Leighton.
So I was just talking about the mall space with Gap. A new retailer that is poised to enter the mall space is going to be focused on PPE. A PPE retailer is going to be trying to make it in a mall setting. And this is interesting because personal protective equipment, you don't really think of that as a brick and mortar type concept. You think of it as, I'm going to go buy a face shield or some nitrile gloves on Amazon.com, not in a mall. So this is fairly interesting. But if you look right now, Trent, this company is fairly interesting. The company is called Shield Pals, and currently they sell a ton of different face shields for the dental community. So if you're going to be a dentist working on, let's say, a child's tooth problem, then you would have a face shield, maybe resemble a cat or a lion or a dog, something to make it friendly for your patrons. But overall, that's pretty much all they sell right now, other than dental visors on their website. So they've been strictly an e-commerce website so far. So the company Hatch Exhibits really is going to look in to a smaller space in Columbia, Maryland, and it's going to be located on the second floor of the mall. Shield Pals will sell masks, gowns, and again, protective face shields that they currently have on their website. They have the line of products on their website, but it's fairly limited. And this is why I'm scratching my head a little bit, Trent, because if this were to be a robust looking ahead story, we could see maybe a slew of different products and inventory on their website. But if you go to shieldpals.com, you pretty much see very little. They have just maybe a handful of face shields. And then, of course, like I said, dental visors and that kind of thing, but maybe only 20 products total. So it's going to be interesting as to how they're going to merchandise this particular store. And then also, are these kinds of concepts going to be popping up in other malls across the country? Because you have retailers, not only Gap, but a number of retailers that are exiting the mall space with, of course, smaller spaces that may be only 900 or 1200 square feet in size, which would in theory be perfect for a PPE retailer if they want to do business. The second point I would like to make here is how long are these leases going to be? Because typically in commercial real estate, especially in the mall space, you see leases at a minimum start at around 3 years in time. So that time frame is going to be far too long, one would think, for PPE equipment. Although this likely, the thesis behind this business model probably is that there's probably going to be a long-term need for PPE equipment. It just has me wondering how long exactly is that lease? And let me see that business model as well, because I'm curious to see if they think that there's going to be demand for this type of product selection in the next 2 years, 3 years. And if so, what that looks like, as a lot of other retailers are probably looking at this, or a lot of other entrepreneurs are looking at this as a potential opportunity.
And it might be something where it's kind of like the cooked meals at home space, the whole Home Chef or Blue Apron. We saw what seemed like hundreds of entrants into that space nearly overnight, and then most of them were either bought out or evaporated. And we could see potentially the same thing in PPE retail as kind of the new horizon of retail, if you will, the horizon that we saw kind of pop up in the 2010s, not just with PPE, but everyone wants to be chasing the most recent trend. As you said, Layton, basically this only works for a long period of time if we're expecting pandemics to just be a way of life going forward. Well, my looking ahead story has to do with Stein Mart, the oft-maligned off-price retailer, said that there is substantial doubt about its ability to survive over the next year after COVID-19 forced store closures. Now, unlike its off-price relatives TJX and Ross and Burlington, Stein Mart in a similar position to Tuesday Morning, in that their cash position going into the pandemic was not very good. They were forced to close a number of their stores. They are exploring strategic alternatives, including a company sale. Now, you might be saying, well, wait, didn't they have a deal worked out for a sale before? And yeah, earlier this year, Kingswood Capital Management agreed in principle with Stein Mart to buy the company at 90 cents per share. That deal fell apart after the pandemic hit. There are several lawsuits that are still unsettled having to do with that particular deal, as Kingswood found it no longer tenable to buy a retailer that was shuttered during the pandemic. The deal kind of fell apart in April. And again, there are still several lawsuits out there. But now Stein Mart, whose stock price has since collapsed, basically, it's about in the 40 to 50 cents per share range, and it has been for the last month or so, they're finding it difficult to locate a buyer. And if they don't locate a buyer, might mean bad news for Stein Mart, which has already shrunk their overall footprint. We've talked about sales dropping for Stein Mart at a time when sales are increasing for other off-price stores. To be honest, the reason I'm looking ahead is, of course, to see if they find a buyer. But if they can't find a buyer, this seems like a company that is ticketed towards bankruptcy and eventual liquidation. I think the issue with Stein Mart's model is when you're an off-price store, you expect for that off-price store to bring certain price points surrounding products. Stein Mart's prices were always a step higher than the likes of TJX, Burlington, and Ross. And as such, you kind of hit this in-between customer demographic. And every time I've been to a Stein Mart, which is several times over the last 5 to 10 years more out of my own curiosity than anything. I've seen mostly empty stores, mostly empty front ends, and it is a stark contrast from the likes of TJX and Ross. And I think at this point, it's a branding issue. It's a marketing issue. How do you get back to marketing to your core customer in off-price, the customers that are looking for authentic values? Just because a polo shirt was once $80 doesn't mean selling it at $40 is going to necessarily bring in customers for you. Because again, you're talking about the off-price customer, and there's not a whole lot of difference between the customer that's going to buy that polo for $40 and would buy a similar polo at regular price at, say, a Kohl's for $30. So they don't really fit into a particular retail mold now in 2020 as they did maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Sales have fallen since 2016 about 10.4% overall. They've posted a consistent net loss over the last 4 years. They've tried different things, including installing some of those Amazon hub lockers. But again, the forced closures took away any semblance of cash flow. And this is something where I kind of expect, looking ahead at this story, it might have a negative ending. Also, please, please redo your logo. It is not an attractive logo to look at, in my opinion, at least. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long for this week. A big thank you to you for listening, and we'll be back approximately 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.